Hi, we are Simone,
Clarissa,
and Lloyd,
and we are reading How to Lie with Statistics by Daryl Huff.
So our quote for today is on page 8, and it says, as Henry G. Felsen, a humorist and no medical authority, pointed out quite a while ago, proper treatment with a cure will cure a cold in 7 days, but left to itself, a cold will hang on for a week.
Now, I feel like this quote is really indicative of what this book represents, right? That's the perfect example of lying with statistics, because obviously you hear something like that, and it's like, a week, so much longer than 7 days, right? It's a joke, clearly, but it represents something.
Yeah, because you'll always have that, like, couple percent of the world that'll be like, oh my god, a week is so much longer than 7 days. When in actuality, a week is 7 days.
Yeah. You guys said what I wanted to say?
No, you start the next one.
Okay, so I wanted to talk about the housing piece of pages, I guess, 0 to 46. Basically, what he was saying was that there are a lot of possibilities to manipulate average, or the meaning of average. He said that he tried to draw people in with saying that if you live in this particular neighborhood, you would make about $30,000 a year. And what he later on said was that this was just the mean, meaning that you add all the numbers and you divide it by how many numbers there are. And this will obviously get you a higher number. As compared to, like, the mode, which would be a couple thousand, or, like, the median, which would be a couple thousand. And I thought it was really cool to see, like, I mean, I definitely would have fell for it if you tell me if I live in a certain neighborhood, I would make this amount of money without even realizing, like, the math behind it.
Right, and that's kind of the point. It's all about how the word average, it seems like such a hard math term. Like, average is this strictly defined thing, but it's really just... it's just a nebulous term. It doesn't, it just means normal. And how do you define normal, really?
Yeah. Yeah. And also made me realize that basically the best way to, I guess the best average would usually be the mode, because it's the most reoccurring number, or like the majority of the people have this amount. And that's better than just saying, you know, what has 50%, or, you know, we're like, add them all up and then divide them.
Right, I find it really interesting that you say that, because a lot of people would say that the median is the best type of average, because it gives you an indication of where most people lie, right? Because I can definitely see situations where the mode is the most useful.
Mm-hmm.
There is a situation about income, average income, that is talked about a bit later in the book, but the median is often used in as opposed to the mode, because mode, well, okay, let's say we have a group of 10 people, and three of them all make $10 a week, and everyone else makes between $1 and $50 a week, right? So the mode would be $10, but that doesn't really tell you about the other 7 people in the group.
I guess to me, using the mode made the most sense, because it was like you have a higher chance of having this number than compared to the other numbers if you were thinking about getting a job based on how much you would get in the long run.
And just to touch on that, I have a little question about this quote I found. It says, the mode, however, is more revealing. Most common rate of pay in this business is $2,000 a year. As usual, the median tells more about the situation than any other single figure does. Half of the people get more than $3,000 and half get less. That's on page 32, and that's just about the housing thing that I said before. I kind of don't really know what it means, so if you guys could, like, help me understand a little bit...
Sure. So, what do you mean? There's an illustration that goes along with with that particular quote.
Yeah.
And what the illustration shows is it's a graph of how much different people make.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's like one person that makes 45,000. I'm doing this from memory, so don't quote me on this. But there's like one person that makes 45,000, one that makes 15,000, two that make 10,000, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's something like 10 that make only 2,000.
Yeah.
And so what it's saying is that if you were to look at the mean, right, it would be somewhere in the middle of 45,000 and 2,000.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be around 5,000, I believe the number was, but that isn't really indicative of what most of the people make, right? Most people make either a lot more or a lot less than that 5,000 number.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at mold, then mold would tell you that the average income is 2,000,
yeah,
right? Because there's 10 people that make 2,000. And that's a little bit better because it tells you how much 10 people make as opposed to not really telling you much of anything.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't say anything about anyone who doesn't make 2,000. It doesn't tell you if there are people above that, below that, which is why the median is good because it tells you, it gives you 3,000, I believe, is the median for this particular example. And it tells you half of the people make more than 3,000 and half make less than 3,000,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, depending
yeah,
on what you
yeah.
want to do with
yeah.
this information, it might not be more useful. You might want to use the mold, but it just gives you a more general idea of where everyone falls.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
All right. So the next thing we want to talk about is there was another cool example in the book of sample size, and it's illustrated by flipping pennies. So what the author of the book did was he flipped 10 pennies to see what the rate of heads and tails is. And he only did the one test, and his test came out with 8 heads and 2 tails. And so he said there's an 80% chance that if you flip a coin, it'll land on heads. Obviously, that's not actually true, right? And the point he's trying to illustrate there is just that sample size matters a lot. If you only have 10 points in the sample, then it doesn't tell you anything at all. And this is a way that people really often use to try to manipulate statistics.
Just to bounce off of that, I understand what you're saying because we're doing that now, Mr. Miles' class, with I guess sample size will be flip pennies and things like that to see heads and tails. And like how he would ask us, like, how many times would it take for you to flip a coin to really convince you that the coin is fair, to convince you that's an, like enough amount of information that you have. And yeah, I definitely think that this example in the book was not realistic, but it's also really hard to figure out how many times would be realistic enough for you, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, because when I think of fair, I think of 50-50. So most, like, oftentimes, like, the first thing people think of is, like, oh, okay, let's flip it 100 times and see, you know, what the outcome is. But it's really hard finding a realistic sample size, I guess.
Yeah, and it's just really hard to know, like,
yeah.
Is 100 times good?
Yeah.
Is 1,000 times good? And even if you do have an idea of, like, what's the perfect sample size, often advertisers won't even tell you what their sample was.
Yeah, they'll just give you the outcome of it.
Which is why you should really be skeptical when you hear, like, 60% of people do this, because who's that 60% of, right?
Yeah.
And so there's another example, of sample size about polio vaccines.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so with the polio incident, people had 450 children get vaccinated and 680 not get vaccinated. And what they saw was that none of the children actually got sick with polio, but that was due to the fact that in that part of the region and in that community, there was a low number of people who would get polio ever, so it made it kind of useless to try to test it if you already know that not a lot of people are going to get it to begin with. So it was kind of a useless study. They should have did it in a place where it was more common for people to actually get polio, and then also their testing sizes weren't even. It would have been fine if they had 500 kids get vaccinated and 500 not vaccinated, then they get 450 vaccinated and 680 not vaccinated. So.
Right. And so that's like, that's about 1,000 people, which if you're flipping pennies, 1,000 is a good sample, but obviously for vaccinating children, it's not. So I think that's the point that this example is trying to illustrate. Like, sample size, what is a good sample size isn't a static thing. It really depends on what you're sampling.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about babies.
Yeah, but we can keep going, it's fine. It'll just be okay. There was a thing called, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, so don't beat me up. Jesus Norm, I don't know what it is. And it was basically saying that your baby should technically know how to sit up straight after it's a couple months old. And it kind of made a lot of parents think that their kids were retarded or that they weren't properly developing because they didn't know how to sit up straight after they were a couple months old.
Right, but obviously if your kids start sitting up a month late, that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with them.
Yeah.
The problem that is in the situation is that they don't tell you that's just an average number.
Yeah.
Right? Because they didn't find that number through median. Or even if they had found that number through median, they don't tell you how far off. They don't tell you the deviation from that number of the average baby. So maybe they found at 12 months your baby should be sitting up. But that came from half of the baby started sitting up at 6 months and the other half at 18 months. So no baby starts sitting up at 12 months.
Yeah. And then he also pointed out that, like, he only made this idea based on observed things, and it was the parents who themselves decided that if their baby didn't do it on time, they were an inferior because they were confusing what was a normal thing for a child to do versus what was a desirable thing for a child to do. Because they desired them to be able to sit up straight after a couple months than it actually being something that's normal and physical for all babies to be able to sit up at that time.
I just think it's like really dangerous how statistics can really like affect a person in their life, because like you have people ready to call their children retarded because they can't sit up at 12 months. You know what I mean? Like it's ridiculous, and it's really interesting to see how statistics is like able to manipulate people. Because I know I probably am manipulated by statistics. Like if someone had told me like 3 out of 4 people, I don't know. Give me an example. 3 out of 4 people,
like 3 out of 4 people get like shingles. Like that makes you like automatically
like I'm one of those people. You know what I mean? So I just think it's really cool, and I can't wait to see what else this book has to offer about some dangerous statistics.
Neither can I. And we'll get to see those things on the next episode
of How to Lie with Statistics.
This has been Lloyd Williams,
Clarissa Hudson,
and Simone McCollum.
Signing out.
Hello, and welcome to our second podcast for How to Lie with Statistics by Daryl Huff. And today we have Clarissa Hudson and
Simone McCollum.
Lloyd isn't here today, I'm sorry. So, for our podcast today, we're going to start with a quote from the book, front cover, and it says, "Round numbers are always false," by Samuel Johnson. And to me, it felt like when he said that, he was saying that whenever you round a number, that automatically makes it untrue because it isn't the actual number that you were given.
I agree. I also believe that round numbers are always false. Even though they're a lot easier to do, they are not really realistic. It's not a realistic way to view information. The best way to view it is with exact numbers, no matter how many millions of numbers are after that decimal point.
But it makes it really interesting because a lot of times people, when they see a really exact number like 15,298.32, they're like, oh, that can't be right. But in actuality, that's more accurate than someone who rounds the number.
So I wanted to talk about one source of sample bias that was mentioned in chapter one, where they said the average Yaleman class of 24 makes $25,111 a year. I guess that was kind of appealing. I'm not really sure. I mean, I don't really think $25,000 is, you know, a vast amount of money, but maybe in that time period it was. I'm not sure, or I don't know if it's the future. I don't know what 24, maybe 1924, is it 2024? Like, I can't really, you know, tell. But I think that when people word something like that, like in this manner, it kind of makes you think like, oh, maybe I want to go to Yale. Maybe I should.
Yeah.
Or maybe I don't want to go to Yale. I mean, depending on how much money you plan on making, like if you get this, like this visual of how much you'll make in the future just by going to Yale, even though that's not true because you have millions of, I mean, not millions, but you have hundreds of majors you can go into making different amounts of money. I mean, it's a lot of factors that can go into it, like did you go straight into school afterwards, things mm-hmm. like that. So I feel like numbers like this, it tricks people, but it's also something important to know.
Yeah, and at the same time, it was like maybe they only got the popular people who are like really big businessmen or did the majors that really paid a lot compared to someone who just went into education or someone who decided to be a nurse. So you have to really, I guess, go behind the scenes and find out who exactly are the Yale men that, or Yale women that they interview for this number.
So I'm going to put the second paragraph on page 18 into my own words. The quote is, "A river cannot rise above its source." And to me, this means that you can't get something more out of what you already have, which is not true. This paragraph elaborates on this by concluding that in different data sets, we're able to get way more information than what we've been told. Thus saying a river cannot rise above its source cannot be true all of the time. I mean, sometimes you get a problem where, like, there you can clearly identify, like, this leads to this and it's nothing more. But
yeah,
most of the time you're able to dig deeper and find different meanings for different conclusions you can make from your numbers.
I guess I'm going to go into explaining why advertisers often rely on a very small sample to substantiate their claims. And when I was reading the book, I kind of saw that people use a very small sample size because they want their data to come out looking a certain way. They want their company to look like they're having profit that's not too much profit to make somebody doing something shady. So they really just go and pick out certain people that they want and certain, I guess, items and aspects that they really want to bring out to draw people in and not turn them away. Because if you go to a company and their data shows that majority of people don't like their food, they're not going to show you that because then you yourself won't buy their food. So they make it look like, and they only interview people who actually do like their food so that you'll end up thinking that, oh, this is a good product, so you'll go and buy it yourself.
I'm going to elaborate on what the author means on page 45 when he says, "Hardly anybody is exactly normal in any way." And what I took from the quote was, there are plenty of ways to view outside factors that can screw up data and paint different pictures. So nothing or no person is always normal all of the time, just like data. A clear example of this can be looking at data that suggests people who go to sleep before 10 receive higher test scores. Sure, sleep is important, but other factors can influence this conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Things like what they ate the night before the test, what they had for breakfast, what they did in the morning, etc. So, I mean, I don't really think that anything is normal. Nothing is going to be perfect. There's always different outside sources, unless you have, like, a controlled environment where every single thing is the same. You might be able to say that it's normal, but I don't think that's a conclusion you can make all of the time.
And that also ties into, I think it was Geisel's norms, where they were talking about how a baby should start crawling or walking by a certain age, and you really can't dictate when a child should or should not be able to do something, because each person is different, and each child develops at their own pace, and also depends on their environment, and factors that we don't see, like Simone was saying. So you really can have no norm in life.
I found a example of a misleading graph. I got it from StricklerWMS.Weebly.com. And basically, it's a picture of a PS3 and a picture of an Xbox 360. And it's saying what's on the... Well, what they're trying to measure is a preferred GTA version percentage. What that is, I'm not really sure. But looking at this graph, I can obviously tell that this graph is misleading. I mean, you see the PS3, and I guess it has more area. So you would assume that, oh, I need a PS3 over Xbox 360, when in reality, that's not true. I mean, they just kind of made the PS3 bigger than the Xbox 360. It's not really telling me what I need to know. Maybe this number is correct, but once again, the area is still larger, so maybe there needs to be a control variable to make sure the area is the same, but, you know, it will have different percentages of the GTA.
My misleading graph was from Passy's World of Mathematics, and it had a bunch of different charts and videos and graphs, and one that really stuck out is where they were comparing days of 2 years from 2007 to 2008 of when they had freezing temperatures, and they changed the scale of the temperatures. Like, it went from 81 to 85 on one graph. On the other graph, it went from 20 to 100. So if you look at the first graph, you would think, oh, these days of freezing temperatures is really different. There was a really big rise in freezing temperatures from 2007 to 2008. But when you look at the second graph, there isn't that much of a difference. Only like a couple, like maybe 2 days that were more in 2008 and 2007. So depending on what graph you look like, it'll represent your data differently.
I was looking on the Gizmodo, I think that's how you say it, website that Mr. Miles suggested we view when talking about the book. And, I mean, I'm seeing some graphs that really don't make sense to me, but I guess the point is it's not supposed to make sense. These are supposed to be, exaggerated examples, like, the one, I mean, I hate Bush, so it just immediately made me look at it, was if Bush tax cuts expire. So, I mean, you have 35% now, and then it said, well, then, whenever they did the mm-hmm. story, and then it has January 1st, 2013, is 39.6%, when, like, I don't know, but it just looks really dramatic just because the way they spread out the percentage is... Mm-hmm. It's really small, so it would make it seem like now, okay, like, oh my God, it's so good, but in 2013 it's gonna raise or whatever. And I mean, you could obviously tell that this is an exaggerated graph. Like, it doesn't make me want to believe what they're saying just because it's so dramatic.
And also, I really would have preferred they put an actual date and not just the word now, because what is now? Is now like 2025? Is it 1982? Like, it makes it really not able to understand all the of what's going on to people who are just looking at it like us without actually knowing the whole situation.
I also wanted to talk about an example on page 79 where it says it was reported that the number of deaths chargeable to steam railroads in one recent year was 4,712. That sounds like a good argument for staying off trains, perhaps for sticking to your automobile instead. But when you investigate to find what the figure is all about, you learn it means something quite different. Nearly half of those victims were people whose automobiles collided with trains at crossings. The greater part of the rest were riding the rods. Only 132 out of the 4,712 were passengers on trains. So, I mean, if you would have told me this, like, wow, 4,712 people, like, you know, died from riding the train, I would be like, wow, like maybe I don't need to be on the train.
I shouldn't do it every
but
day.
But once
no
you
more.
Dig deep, I mean, I feel like when people give these numbers, they also need to tell us what's happening around it. Like, don't just tell me that 4,000 people died, like, by train without saying, like, oh, well, this amount of people died because their car collided with the train.
It's
not necessarily because they were on the train. You know what I mean? So I really like this example because it helped me break down my point where I say I need to know about those outside factors.
Yeah.
And it also allows us to know that it's really easy to lie with statistics. Like, you'll find that one person who's probably like, wow, like, maybe I don't need to do this, that, and the third. I need to change my whole lifestyle because of this one statistic, but they don't really know all that goes into it.
Like, if I, like, me personally, because I ride the train every day, like, if I knew that, like, almost 5,000 people died just from being on the train every day, it would make me not want to get on there. But when I actually find out only 132 really died, I'm just like, oh, that's light. That's nothing. Like, they make it so that people are, like, they want to waver from what they usually do in their usual life. Because maybe this is a company that wants to get people to ride their cars more so they can go use gas more than being on the train and not being able to, like, be involved in the economy and stuff. But it depends on, it makes it people really not want to do things. And going on that website that Mr. Miles had us on, there's another thing for the 2012 presidential run where it says 70% back Palin, 60% back Romney, and 63% back Huckabee. And that doesn't add to 100%. So that's kind of throwing me off just right off the bat, because if it doesn't add to 100%, then you just know automatically that your statistics aren't correct because you shouldn't have anything over 100%. So.
And also, I just wanted to talk about one more example of how I found the example of the misleading graph with the Xbox and the, the PS3.
Mm-hmm.
And on page 72 of How to Lie with Statistics, they have the Kresivkov, I don't really know how to say it, but, they have this really tiny cow in 1860, and in 1936, it seems like it's just like a grown man cow. And it's so exaggerated, but we don't really know what this means. Like, okay, we see the bigger cow in 1936, but what made it grow? You know what I mean? Like, what are the outside factors that made it that big? So I just feel like this is another example of changing area is going to change, you know, the statistic, which doesn't really make sense. And they also have another example of the rhino in 1515 when it's huge, in 1936 when it's relatively small. And it's just like, how does changing the area change the meaning of the statistic? And I feel like a lot of these visual statistic things that we see, I can't really talk about one that I've seen on a day-to-day basis, like at my bus stop or anything, because I don't really see those. But, like, I don't know, seeing things like this would kind of change my thinking. I think I might fall victim to it sometimes because, like, it's easier to see that if something is bigger, it makes us want to pay more attention to it. So especially if there's such a difference between big and small, we want to figure out that gap. And I think that's the book does a good job of explaining why we don't need to just look at the picture, why we need to dig deeper.
Because generally, if you see something going from being small to going big, you're like, oh, my goodness, this is getting better. It's getting more popular. Like, it's booming, and you want to, like, get involved in it. Whereas if you see something going down, then you're just like, oh, why would I even? Unless it's something like poverty's going down, because then you'd be like, oh, okay, that's good. But generally, if you saw something going up or going down, you would, if it was a really big, drastic change, you would be more interested into it. And, like, now I see myself, every time I see a graph, I'm like, let me check this out real quick. Make sure they're not lying. But, like, the book makes you want to actually look at things more.
Okay, this was our second podcast. This is Simone McCollum.
And Clarissa Hudson.
Signing off.
Hello all, and welcome to the third and final episode of the How to Lie with Statistics podcast. I'm Lloyd Williams,
Clarissa Hudson,
and Simone McCollum.
And we're here to talk about how to lie with statistics. So we're going to start by talking about something called a semi-attached figure. What is a semi-attached figure, you may ask? It's a figure that's related to a topic, but with information missing that means that the relationship that people may draw isn't completely accurate.
Okay. Thank you, Lloyd, for that. We're going to talk about post hoc mean. I hope I'm saying that right. Basically, post hoc means, I'll give you an example and let you figure it out yourself. So the example in the book was that if you attend college, then if you attend a four-year college or university as opposed to doing anything else 4 years of your life, then you'll be making more money. And they call this a post hoc because you can't really, like,
you can't really make that
assumption between the two, you know, things. Like, there are things that can happen in 4 years to make someone a lot more richer than, you know, someone who actually attended college or university. And you also have to take into account, like, did that person take out loans? Do they have to pay back? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's all depending on... Yeah.
And then they also brought up how if a person goes to college already rich, then they're obviously going to have more money compared to somebody else if they don't go to college at all or if they do go to college. So if you're, like, they brought up, what is it, the rich raise the rich or something
like that. The rich or the
bright. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then another example of a post hoc is when they talked about people having lice. And so they were saying just because people seem to be in good health when they have lice, everyone came up with the assumption that you have to get lice in order to stay healthy and that by having lice, you would live longer and have a better, healthier life. But you can't assume that by having lice, that's better for you because they do make you sick.
Yeah.
And that's really the problem with the post hoc fallacy. You can't draw conclusions only from the few data points that you look at. That's why when you do experiments, you come up with a hypothesis that you're trying to prove beforehand. When you just look at things afterwards, there are things that you can miss that you weren't accounting for.
I wanted to take a second to talk about where in the book they say who says so when I was coming to, you know, conclusion reading the book. And basically... their advice is to kind of look beyond the name because they said that, you know, laboratory names are okay, university names are okay, anything within the medical profession is okay. Like, if you hear doctor such and such says this, like, you'll be more likely to believe it. But they also suggest that you don't really pay attention to the name because I'll read an example. He says... the writer who proved a few chapters back that higher education jeopardizes a girl's chance to marry made good use of the okay name of Cornell. Please note that while the data came from Cornell, the conclusions were entirely the writer's own, but the okay name helps you carry away a misimpression of Cornell University says dot, dot, dot. When an okay name is cited, make sure that the author stands behind the information, not merely somewhere alongside of it. So... that makes a lot of sense. It's like, okay, just because someone goes to Cornell, they can draw their own conclusion, and we'll still be gullible to say, oh, Cornell says this, when it's not actually Cornell. It's actually, you know, just someone who probably goes to Cornell and is, you know, really opposed to whatever they're trying to prove. Well, not prove.
And it was really interesting because the study that was done by at Cornell University was actually incorrect because they were saying people who go to college, men are less likely to stay a bachelor if they go to college, whereas women are more likely to become an old maid if they go to college. And that really wasn't, like, right, and it was really incorrect. And it made a lot of women question whether or not they even wanted to go to college because they didn't want to be stuck and become an old maid once they graduated, because that's kind of a waste of your life, just be a maid and not be able to get married and have kids and, like, enjoy your life. So it really goes to show that you can't just, like, that can make somebody not like Cornell, or that can make someone who's for women being maids really, like, enjoy Cornell. So...
right, and I'd just like to point out that it's not, strictly speaking, that it was incorrect. It's just that the conclusions they drew from it were completely wrong. Because it's not that going to college makes it so that you won't get married. It's that the people who went to college at that time were just people who were generally less likely to get married.
Where are the pictures? From my phone. Can you email them to yourself?
So another issue with the way that data is represented sometimes is shown in an example in the book, The Darkening Shadow. in the example, they're trying to show how much the government takes for taxes by comparing it to the annual income of certain states. So in the first picture, most of the western coast of the United States is shaded in because the government takes more than the entire income of those states. And it makes it look like a huge amount because they have those states have a lot of mass. But what you don't take into consideration when you look at this map is that those states also have a much lower population density than states like New York or Pennsylvania. So when you look at a similar graph that that instead shades in places on the East Coast, it's only about four or five states that are actually shaded in because they have a lot more people, so they have a lot more income.
That really also goes to show how people can tweak graphs, like we used to say in our earlier podcast, to make it look good or to make it more appealing or to get people to buy into what they're thinking or to think that their conclusions are in fact correct.
While reading this book, we've all taken away different parts that I guess mean something different to each of us. I guess I'll start. I like the what's missing piece of the book, only because I felt like in these last couple chapters, he really started making sense to me. Like, he really started breaking things down. And what he said was, one study shows that in 2,800 cases, over half of the mothers were 35 or over. And he says, getting any meaning from this depends upon you knowing something about the ages at which women in general produce babies. Few of us know things like this. And I agree, because I also don't really know what I would take away from this besides the fact that, you know, a lot of people who had babies were 35 or over, but, like, what does that mean? So that's how next time I know when I'm looking at a situation or an event, I'll look for what's missing and what I'm being told so I can figure out how I can draw a better conclusion with, I guess, knowing what's absent and knowing what's present.
I guess for me personally, I really, this book helped me open my eyes to, like, just look at the, I guess, statistics and things that I see all around differently. And at bottom line, what he says is that, like, does it make sense? Like, when you really have to go look at something and look, like, go deeper into what it's saying and what it's showing you to see, does it really make sense? Is it really something that you think could be possible in the world? Or is it just them making it up so that it could look good in people's eyes to just glance at it without asking any questions? So for me, like, that was just a big takeaway. And he was really, like, real about it. Like, he wasn't trying to be sweet or sugarcoat anything. He was like, people lie with statistics. It happens every day, everywhere. There's nothing you can really do about it. And there's no real way of having something be 100% true, because there's always going to be somewhere in the world where it's not actually correct or it's not actually 100% going to work out that way.
Right, and I think that's really what I took away most from this book, is that, you know, you can do pretty much whatever you want, but no matter what, if someone wants to trick you with their graph or their data points or whatever, they're gonna be able to. So you can't just look at whatever statistics they give to you. You have to go and find the data yourself and pick it apart and draw your own conclusions. And I mean, of course, then you can compare it to their conclusions, but you can't just take anything that they say at face value, because, I mean, they can hide it.
So
we're going to end off this final podcast with one of the quotes from the front of the book that we haven't done yet. Artemis Ward says, "It ain't so much the things we don't know that get us in trouble. It's the things we know that ain't so." And I think that really, that personifies what this book is about.
Yeah. And so signing off for the final and last time, Clarissa Hudson,
Lloyd Williams,
and Simone McCullum.
Thank you.